2024 is the year of podcasts, and we want to let you know about a brand new show that is live right now. Join with me to share the good news about the Worthy of Everything podcast. It's just one of the two hosts, Jedra Lasso. Jedra, you've been working on this podcast in the background. Our team has been very excited as we've been preparing for its launch. How does it feel to know that the episodes finally are out there and we're moving forward every single week?
It is so exciting, and I am just excited to see where God takes it. And I have so much hope that it is going to be an incredible blessing to the listeners.
Amen, amen. But as I understand it, this is a show tackling the issues of mental health through the lens of the gospel. Can you share just a little bit more about the heart and the intent and who you're really trying to serve through the Worthy of Everything podcast?
So I personally was freed from depression, and as I've come to understand my freedom from sin and identity in Christ, I start to recognize all these amazing gifts that God has given us. So yeah, just exploring and hearing awesome testimonies about how to walk out true intimacy with a loving father who pursues his kids.
Oh man, sounds like a good time. If you want to check out the show, lovereality.org/podcasts, and look for the Worthy of Everything show.
The world doesn't think that the gospel can change your life, but we know that it can. And that's why we want you to hear these stories, stories of transformation, stories of freedom, people getting free from sin and healed from sin because of Jesus. This is Death to Life.
That's probably like 34 weeks when the doctors found out that Wesley had some brain malformities. And I was like, what does that mean? And he said, we don't know. We won't know until he's born. And I just stopped and I felt God's presence over me. And I did not have anxiety in that moment. I heard be still. I don't know how I heard it, but like I felt it. I just felt like I was lifted up and I was just held by him. And I knew that everything was going to work out.
Yo, welcome to the Death to Life podcast. My name is Richard Young, and today's testimony is with my friend, Jordan. And I want to tell you right now that you're probably going to want to send Jordan's story to a friend. If anyone has dealt with anxiety, fear, lies, send Jordan's story, and I think it will hit. They may not have the background that Jordan has, but the story will encourage and edify them. And so please send it. Send it to a friend. Jordan, I think she's one of the first people on the podcast that I've interviewed that is from Kansas City, Missouri, which makes her extra special to me because you know that's where I'm from. But Jordan's life, ups and downs, mostly downs, and it gets pretty heavy. And so I want to throw out a disclaimer that it's not for young ears, but there's so much beautiful stuff in it. So let's get into the podcast right now. Buckle up, strap in. Love y'all. Appreciate y'all. So Jordan, tell us, where does your story start?
I'd say my story starts in my childhood. I had it was pretty traumatic for me. I don't think I realized how traumatic it was until I started seeing patterns develop as I got older. My mother, it was just me, my mom, and my sister, two separate dads. They both struggled with addiction. So it was just us three girls in the house. My mom also struggled with some mental health issues, bipolar. My sister had a lot of rage issues just from bouncing back between a very abusive home and then my mom. So it was like a battlefield in our house. So I found myself, I was like the punching bag of the family, always walking on thin ice, making sure nothing got too bad to where it would get explosive. So I just withdrew myself a lot, and I would be really careful of what I would say and what situations I'd interject in the family.
So you learned pretty quickly that you have to protect yourself from where you lived. What did the protecting yourself just look like? You just wanted to stay away from home, or?
I would stay in the house. First, before I withdrew myself, I actually many times tried to interject myself in situations. And when I'd see my mom and my sister start screaming, or I'd see my mom start getting like somewhat frustrated about little things, I would try to jump in and help. And I'm like, it's okay, mom, it's okay. And I'd do my best to be like the good child to keep everything, keep everyone in a good mood so nothing would get explosive. But most of the time, it would end with my mom going into a very like aggressive, like manic state and screaming. And so that's whenever I'd back off. And then at some point that turned into, I knew I couldn't fix it. And I started taking that really hard too, that I couldn't help, and just escalated into like, maybe I'm the reason. Like maybe every time I say something and I try to help, the situation gets worse. So I moved into the basement, and that was around 12, 13 years old is when I started withdrawing myself and started battling my own demons and issues, and really internalized a lot of that, a lot of the things that were going on.
What would you say, and you don't have to get too specific, what were you say the demons that you were battling were?
So, yeah, that one's kind of hard. I just found my own way to cope, and I found the internet and a lot of graphic stuff on the internet. So I struggled with that around, that was probably like 12, 13 years old, is whenever I started like just going on my phone, getting on websites I shouldn't be on. And I just stay down in my basement for like just hours at a time, and just would try to just like, that was my reality of that's what I would do with my time.
Did you feel like it was wrong?
Yeah, I felt like it was wrong, and I would cry every time. And I did have, we were raised like Christian. We grew up like Pentecostal. And I just knew that was very shameful and that was disgusting. And so I would cry every time. I was like, I'm not going to do it again. I'm not going to do it again. But every day I'd get home from school, I'd go lock myself in the room and I'd do it again. It was just...
Yeah, it became an addiction.
Yeah, it was an addiction. And that was like that brief moment that made me happy. That, not even happy, that made me feel okay. But then whenever I would just go back to my everyday life, I was like, I'm disgusting. I'm sinful, I'm gross. And so it just spiraled into withdrawing myself more and more, becoming very angry with myself.
So if you grew up Pentecostal, what did you think that God, what did you think he thought about you? Who was he?
I knew that God loved me, is what I was always told. And I was like, God loves me. God loves me. He'll forgive me. But that was the extent, like, okay, he'll forgive me if I ask for forgiveness and I repent. But that's really the relationship that I had with him. So I would do things. I would lash out in anger. I had these just like awful thoughts in my head all the time. I was putting on a really happy face and I was trying to make everyone around me smile and laugh, because that's what I knew to do to just go about my day, to survive and keep everything moving. But in private, I was angry. I was gross, and I didn't want to be vulnerable with God, because it was almost just, it felt embarrassing to me to keep repenting and asking for forgiveness, knowing that I want to do it again. So I didn't want to have a real relationship with God, because that's just a waste of his time. Why would I keep doing that? And I didn't feel loved or any freedom. I just kept repenting and kept repenting until it got old and I just stopped talking to him.
The internet has been around for, I don't know, a little under 30 years, but not in the way it was when in 2010 or 2000. Like, the internet's gotten crazier and crazier. And so many people have dealt with the exact thing that you're talking about.
Yeah.
But they think, oh, I'm the only one. They think they're disgusting. We all live these private lives that we're being tortured. We're just trying to figure it out. And yeah, I think that it's like hearing just this part of the story, mm-hmm. I've experienced that. My buddies have experienced that.
Yeah.
But we don't talk about it because there's so much, that people don't understand about the gospel. They don't understand about freedom. So their best advice is like, or try really hard, or God forgives you even though, but there's no victory.
No.
But the story sounds so familiar and it's so sad.
Yeah, it is. And people who hear that, if they know that there's no freedom and that you're not actually going to be different, that's still you. And I feel like people put that label. I really didn't think that was going to come out, because I still don't talk about it a lot just because it's taboo and it's just not something that I usually include as part of my journey. But it was a big part of where I started to feel just enslaved to just, it was evil. It was just, I felt enslaved to evil. And I started just feeling like that's who I am. And it's just part of that I have to hide.
And I'm pretty sure you learned all about life from that, which I think obviously will have ramifications in the future. And I'm not I'm talking about in your story in the future, not now. So what happened next? You're in the basement, 12, 13, stuff's not going well at home.
Yeah, I got into that cycle. That just became the norm. That just became part of my everyday routine. And I would go back to school. And at school, I was the happiest, happy-go-lucky. I was Goofy Jordan, which I still feel like that is me. I'm Goofy Jordan, and I love making people smile, but it was from an unhealthy place. It was from a place of almost like making up for how awful I thought I really was. I'm just this angry, disgusting, gross person. But if I go to school and with all my friends, if I go into overdrive and I'm just laughing and making everyone smile, maybe I'm making up for it in public. So that was the only time I was happy, was around people. I became an insane people pleaser. And I started developing this need to make everyone happy and this need to not be a disappointment. So I developed an insane fear of failure and disappointment. I couldn't let anyone down. And then I had an experience that sounds so funny now. I started playing sports, which was like fun for everyone else. That was just like what you did with your friends and competition. It's just a really fun thing for a normal, like a middle schooler, high schooler to do. But for me, the fear of being on a team and even making the slightest mistake just would crush me. And so I was so scared to even play sports, even though I had fun. And then at a game, oh my gosh, it was so embarrassing. It was awful. I made a basket for the wrong team. And I just remember, looking up and I wanted to like puke my heart out. And I just stopped. And my friends were like, "What is wrong with you?" And I'm just like, I just shut down. It was mortifying, but everyone else laughed it off. I took that way too hard, because not only was it just like a silly mistake, but I had always thought that of myself. Like I was like, I'm going to fail. Everything I did, I was like, I'm going to fail. I'm going to mess up. And that just validated that I could and would mess up if given the opportunity. And to see everyone so like, I was just so embarrassed and everyone so disappointed me. Like, not just my friends disappointed me, but like a whole crowd, like a whole arena full of people was like disappointed in me. And that little 14-year-old Jordan was like, yep, that's it. That's right. I'm never going to disappoint someone ever again. Never going to put myself in a situation where people rely on me or count on me, because I'm going to fail and I'm going to let them down. And I stopped playing team sports after that.
You have a different high school story than most of us. I've heard a little preview of your high school story.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just, like, oh, yeah, and then I got through high school. What? Tell us how it's different.
Oh, no, not this far. Okay. Freshman year of high school, I was at William Chrisman High School, and it was like a pretty big high school, public school. Freshman year was pretty normal. I had some little goofy friends. We got into trouble. We were just goofy kids. And then early sophomore year is when my depression like got the worst, and I was burnt out from people pleasing and being the funny person. I got tired of it. And I realized when I started coming to school and not being the happy, funny person, that people didn't want to really be around me anymore. Like, that's kind of what my value was making people smile and laugh. And when I no longer had anything to give in that aspect, then my friend group got really small and I was more isolated until I met this guy and he really, really liked me. And it was like the first time, and probably it felt like forever, that someone wanted to be around me. Like, even if I was sad, even if I wasn't happy, Jordan, he wanted to be around me. He made effort to every day come pick me up after school. And I started clinging onto him. He became like my safety blanket. He became what validated like what I was worth, because he really just saw worth in me. And he told me that all the time. So I clung on to him. And then he was a couple years older than me. And he got close to graduation. And he was like, he knew my home situation and it was really bad. So he was like, you know what? I'm going to join the Marine Corps and I'm going to get us out of here. And so he got out. He got out of high school, graduated, enlisted in the Marine Corps. And when he got back from boot camp, he proposed to me. And me, I didn't have a good parental guidance, anyone that was telling me, this is not a good idea. Stay home, go to college. I failed five classes my freshman year. My mom ended up signing for me to get married. So she signed her rights away and she said, I love you. He's going to take better care of you than I can. And that it was starting to go downhill at home anyway. My mom was in the process of losing her house. She had just started getting into drugs and that was like my escape. Yeah, I did. I loved him and I loved that he made me feel loved and I felt protected and safe. I didn't care if that was like how all the other kids were doing it. That for me was the way my life was going to go. I pretty much packed up and followed him. And first that took us to North Carolina. And I was...
Wait, hold up. Did you think, oh, this is a good idea right away? Or what did you think when he proposed?
Oh, yeah. I had no like concerns that because pretty much my life was so unstable that something that was so out of the ordinary and so like outrageous seemed normal to me. And that seemed like a safe bet. And I felt safe with him. I had even moved out of my mom's house a couple months prior and I had started living with his mom. And she had started taking care of me. And I just felt like I had a support system finally that was going to be there for me. And whenever he asked me to marry him, I was like, yeah, this is good. This is safe. He's shown me more love and stability than I've had in the past few years. But there was no even thought of if this fails, what am I going to do? Like I didn't think I was going to go anywhere, even if he didn't come into the picture. I had already told myself in my mind, I had decided I'm going to fail. I'm probably going to end up on the street. I don't know what I'm going to do. I just know I was so depressed. I didn't care. I knew that I wasn't going to get into a college. I didn't have friends. I didn't have family. So I was like, it is what it is. There was not a lot of hope for me at that point.
And so you're like, this guy will get me out of this.
Yeah.
You really loved him.
Yeah, I did love him. He was, he's just...
What's his name?
His name is Anthony Simpson. And he is my husband now. And he's still my husband. So. Yeah.
So Anthony, floppy haired Anthony. You were 16 when you got married.
Yep. I was 16 when I got married and my mom signed my rights away and I was emancipated. And then it was just me and him at this point against the world.
So you moved to North Carolina?
Yeah. First we went to North Carolina for a couple months. I enrolled myself in high school. That was really fun. I just walked in there and I was like, what do you need for me to enroll? And they were like, your parent. And I was like, showed him my marriage license. And I was like, I am my parent. I have legal authority. And so they're like, all right, your social security card and everything else. And I just did all the paperwork and I started a couple weeks later. And that was fun being the new kid and then also being the weird married new kid. So I still remember this one time that there was this kid in the hallway that was trying to flirt with me. And I was like, my friend says you're cute. And I went, oh, my ring's off. That's awkward. I was like, I'm married. And he was like, what the heck? That's so weird. So I was proud of it, even though everyone was like, that's really weird.
Yeah. You were a junior in high school?
Yeah. At this point, yeah, I was a junior in high school. This is actually I missed a little spot right before, but I also moved to another place in Missouri before North Carolina. But yeah, this is my third high school at this point.
Yeah, I would have been shook if a junior showed up and I was like, oh, what's up, girl? And she was like, married. I'd be like, oh, my gosh.
It was hilarious.
I'm going to let her cook. I'm going to let her do her thing. My
high school teachers had a lot to say about that, too.
What did they tell you?
Oh, they were definitely like, I had this one social studies teacher that was like, I don't know who you think you are, but the odds are not in your favor, and that is not going to work.
What'd you say?
I was like, you don't know us. We're in love.
We're in love.
You know what he's saying? He's like, yeah, okay. You have fun with that.
Oh, man. So what was marriage like?
Marriage was good for the first couple months.
I thought you were going to say a couple years. For the first half hour.
It was great. Yeah. Whenever it felt like we were very just puffed up, like, yeah, it's just me and you against the world. We're going to do it. And we just tried to like take everything head on. And it was great until I realized now I'm out in North Carolina. I had not one friend, not one family member that I'm in contact with. And I'm still cutting myself off because I'm still depressed. I'm just covering it up with hanging out with him and him making me happy. I started relying on him solely for my happiness. And he couldn't give me that every day. If you're relying on someone to be your light, some days they're going to have a bad day. And so whenever he would have a bad day, I would have a bad day. And I had no unconditional love being given to me. So I was just like, I couldn't love him. And so we just started not fulfilling each other. And I went right back to isolating myself. And things just started getting really dark for me again. And I started projecting that onto him. And he really wanted to be that caretaker. Like, he signed on for that role of like, he knew I was sad and he knew I needed help. And he thought he could really help me. And then once we had no one else and he realized, oh, wow, like I can't help her. He got really torn down too. And he felt like he couldn't help. And he couldn't be that for me either. So we were both just stuck in a really dark place. But we still stayed together because we really loved each other. And we wanted to make it work. But we just couldn't figure it out.
Mercy.
It was a dump.
So how long were you in North Carolina?
North Carolina was only about 6 months until he got his orders to come back to Missouri out of all places, which doesn't happen for Marines very often. But yeah, after 6 months or so, we came back to Missouri and we were stationed in Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri.
Yeah. How old are you? You're 17.
Yeah.
What? Tell me the story. What happens? What keeps... what's next?
So 17, we come back to Missouri. We get stationed in Fort Leonard Wood. And it's still very isolated because it's still just me and him. And I don't know if anyone listening has ever went through, like, when you're in a really dark, like, place in your head, you don't... Even if you have people that would want to help you, you don't reach out. Like, you find comfort in this little dark spot and you don't want anyone to know. So I just didn't talk to anyone still. I just held it together the best that I could every day. I enrolled myself in high school again in Fort Leonard Wood. And that would have been the place that I ended up graduating from. I didn't make any meaningful connections. I did the same thing that I've done since the beginning of high school. late middle school is I would go to school. I'd be happy-go-lucky Jordan, make everyone laugh, come home, hate my life. And having a husband who loved me didn't change anything at this point, because now I was convinced that he hated me. And so we just bounce that off of each other all the time, just angry. You're not enough. You're not being enough for me. And we didn't know where to go from there, but we still stuck together. So it was just that cycle. It was slowly getting worse and worse at that point. And it just got worse. And there was a few times that we tried leaving each other. I was like, I'm going to leave. And I would go back to my grandparents' house for a couple weeks. And just not really because I wanted to leave, but because I wanted him to love me and I wanted him to appreciate me. And I was like, maybe if he doesn't have me, he'll want me back. And that's an awful cycle to get into. That's not a game to play of, you can't have me. So we started that cat and mouse thing. The worst part was when I left, he was happy. I was getting my self-worth from how much he wanted me and how much he loved me. Whenever I took myself away from him and he still was like fine, I was like, wow, that means I have no meaning. Like I have no meaning to you. If I can remove myself from this situation and you don't care. But I had nowhere else to go. And so I went right on back and I sat there and I just begged and I was like, please love me. And he still loved me, but didn't change anything, didn't change our dynamic, didn't change how we treated each other. We just stayed in this cycle. And that happened a few times. And there was really no looking up. It wasn't going to change.
What was the plan moving forward? What was your plan?
Man, it just felt like I didn't have a plan. Since day one, I was like, I'm not going anywhere. I don't have family that's made it to the other side, that they can help me out, that I'm going to go to college. I had no money, barely passed high school. I did the bare minimum to just graduate. And I was like, I didn't even know where to go. I didn't even have someone to tell me, like, how do you go find a job? Like, how do you go to college? I left when I was 16 and I pretty much just said, I'm going to just follow him around and his love will be enough to keep me afloat. I don't need anything else. And it was so sad that I thought that poorly of myself and how little I was worth and how I didn't have a future. I didn't think there was a plan going forward. Before we moved to Hawaii, it was finally just so toxic that I was like, we have to leave. And Anthony was even like, you need to go home. I'll help you support you until you can get on your feet, and I'll help you with doing whatever you need to do, but you need to leave. And yeah, so we were in the process, we were thinking about doing that. We had started packing my stuff. We had started looking for places back in Kansas City for me. And Anthony was going to get out of the military. He was going to end his career and he was going to stay in Missouri, stay close. But we were going to try to separate and divorce. And then some crazy stuff happened. Then some crazy stuff happened.
How'd you end up deciding to move to Hawaii with him then?
It was not a decision that we made. It was out of our hands, honestly. The only decision that was really made was Anthony was like, I think I might stay in the military. So he took an extension to give him another month to decide to think on his future. And in that month, I went to the doctor and I was like, I think my thyroid is messed up. And the doctors looked at my labs and they're like, oh, yeah, absolutely. Your thyroid's messed up. Take this medication. Call us back in a few weeks. And as soon as I get home, they call me. My doctor calls me back and says, do not take that medicine. And I was like, why not? And there was just that long dreaded pause. And I was like, I'm sick. I'm sick. Like, she's going to tell me something really bad. And she was like, you're pregnant. And I was like, that's way worse than being sick. My heart just sank. And then she said, and you're very pregnant. And then it sank even further. So she told
me. Like, how many weeks along were you?
4 months.
What? How did you not know you were pregnant if you didn't? I don't know exactly how a woman's body works, well, like, but I know that
no,
it's something that stops happening if you're pregnant.
I had already been taking something that had been stopping that from happening anyway, so I didn't even have that situation. Okay. So there was really no signs besides I have hypothyroid, and so a lot of the like weight gain and like symptoms that are hormonal often happen with a thyroid condition. So she didn't even think that either. And she was like, yeah, you're about 16 weeks. And I went in that day. There was that.
No morning sickness? You didn't have any morning sickness?
Not really. No.
Good for you. This is a lesson to us all. If you don't believe that you're pregnant, no morning sickness.
It was honestly ignorance is bliss. There was no thought in my mind that I could ever be pregnant. That was not like, this could happen. So yeah, that happened. And that day, she just didn't. My doctor's, all right, I'll see you later and we'll be doing an ultrasound. There wasn't a chance for me to think, oh my gosh, what is this going to affect my future?
What did Anthony say?
Anthony didn't talk for 3 days.
Because you guys were for sure going to get a divorce.
Yeah, we were. It was like pretty heavily like that was what was going to happen. And we still like, at this point, we still just really cared for each other. So it was like, it was a weird situation because like we still wanted to be together, but we were like, this is like not a good, we're not going anywhere like this. It's not good for either of us. So whenever I told him that, I was like, hey, by the way, guess what? I'm pregnant and I'm 4 months pregnant. Want to go out to eat? And he was just like, I need some time. And he just sat there on the couch, like staring at the TV for 3 days until it like hit him. And he was like, all right, I guess I need to reenlist then. And we need to be stable. And we got to get a new car for the baby. We have to have a safe mom car. And he just started going into dad mode. And I was like, all right, I guess this is what we're doing.
Okay, we're going to take a little break right now. And the break is for me to tell you to send this mug to a buddy, to a friend, the person that has been put in your heart right now, they just popped in there, send it to them. And this is how it works. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word. So send it to a homie, and now we'll get back to Jordan's story.
How old were you?
I think I was 19, 20 years old.
And so then the next thing when he reenlisted was you're going to Hawaii?
Yeah, a week after that, they were like, okay, we're sending you to Hawaii. And so I was like, okay, so 2 weeks ago, I was going to get a divorce. I was going to move back home. I was trying to plan what could happen for me. And now I'm 4 months pregnant. I'm staying with my husband. And we're going to go live on an island where I know nobody and I have no escape if stuff gets bad. So that was
part. You can go from 0 to 4 months pregnant in 2 weeks.
Hey, it's crazy science.
That's crazy. So you weren't excited about Hawaii at all? Oh, it's beautiful or anything like that?
Well, at that point, what I would have been excited about going to Hawaii would have been like drinking Mai Tais on the beach all day and not having a job and not having any responsibilities. But I am now pregnant. And I'm going to have like, the biggest responsibility ever. So no, now I was just a little scared. I was just a little scared about going.
Yeah, that does change, change it. I'm like, ooh, Hawaii, go surfing. And you're like, okay.
Yeah, I was like heavily pregnant.
So you get out to Hawaii. How was the first year there? Talk to me.
Now I'm getting all excited because this is when it starts getting good. There's a lot of doom and gloom before this point, but this is when everything happened for me and when my life changed. So me and Anthony get out there and obviously the first thing, we got the Hawaii air. So we're like, we're feeling excited. You can't be mad when you just step off the plane and you're like, oh, I'm living in Hawaii now. So the environment was a lot better. We were like, we removed ourselves. We were now removed from all those people that knew all that like nasty baggage about us. And so it felt like a little weight off of our shoulders. And we were like, we're going to be different. We're going to make this work because we're a family now. I mean, I was still a little sad with him because there was still a lot of like baggage and trauma, but we were just hanging out, trying to make the best of the island and the situation. And we went to Windward Mall one day. Mm-hmm. And there was this little store, this little Christian store called Bless. And mm-hmm. we were, oh my gosh, look, a cute little Christian store. And they had Chiefs jerseys. They had blessed Chiefs jerseys. And
let's go.
And I was like, my gosh, look, we got to get these for the family. And so we made our way into this little Christian store and we're picking out all these Chiefs jerseys for the whole family. And that's when our now really good friend Leanne was working. And she says she usually is not working there, but she was working and she made conversation with us. And she told us, she was like, I don't do this very often, but she started poking around asking about our faith. And we said we were Christian. And she's like, you should come to a youth group with me. We have a really awesome young adult group. And so she invited us to the Simply Worship and not thinking that we were actually going to show up. So we showed up and she introduced us to Tyler and Morgan. She introduced us to all of our now like best friends. And Tyler was actually sharing his testimony there that night. And I was just mesmerized by everything he was saying. I was like, this is witchcraft. There's no way this is possible. What do you mean? What do you mean you're different? Like, how did you overcome all that? And so I just really clung on to the things he was saying. I wanted to know more. And me and Anthony were there at every event. Every time Tyler and Morgan and Leanne and all the young adults were doing something and doing like worship services and going to the beach, we were just following them because like they were preaching the gospel and it was just like making its way in and we just wanted to hear more. And so we became really close with them and they were just the friends that they were always just speaking life over us all the time. Like they just came alongside of us. And just even like when we were in like the pits and it was really bad for us, they were just speaking life over us. And slowly but surely, it was just
so
making sense.
When you're first starting to hear what Tyler's saying,
yeah.
What was something that was sticking out to you that you're like, maybe I don't understand this, or maybe what was different about what he was saying?
Different about what he was saying was that he didn't have to work to be how he is now. Like he explained the trauma and the way he used to be. And he explained the same concept that I had always heard, which was just like, you mess up, you keep trying, keep working at getting closer to God and, you know, do what God says and repent. And you'll get better and God will forgive you. So it was that mindset of the same thing I grew up of. Repent, God will forgive, you'll go to heaven. And that had been my like mentality. I used to have such a fear of messing up. I repented just like 24/7, but I repented out of fear of hell. I repented because I had this like thought that if I sinned and I went to sleep without repenting, that God would still remember that sin. And yeah. Every sin was the same. Like every sin was just as bad. So I would go to hell. And I like terrified of death. I was just terrified of life. And that's why I pretty much just pushed all that to the side. I was like, I don't want to think about God anymore. I don't want to think about the possibility of going to hell because it was so scary to me. And he was preaching something different than that.
Did you guys have a one-on-one with them right away or start kicking it with them right away? Or was it just because you're the dream for every evangelist or every somebody who's planning a church is for somebody to show up and be in love with what you're saying and then start going to your church?
That's what we did. We just loved what they were saying. And we were like, we need this. And we were like, what church do you guys go to? And they're like, oh, we're out in Houla. And we started driving up to Houla every Saturday. And we'd go early and we'd spend the day with them. And yeah, they would hang out with us one-on-one.
Was going to church on Saturday, how did that hit you at first?
I didn't really think anything of it. We asked questions about it and they explained the Sabbath and explained a day of rest. And they were like, oh, it's a little different. We didn't think too deep.
And you were like, cool. Yeah. We'll just go on Saturday.
Yeah. We're going on Saturday now. We didn't care about the denomination or whatever, because we were like, whatever you're saying, I knew there was something there. I knew there was truth there. And it was like hitting my heart. And I wanted to know more about that. And so, yeah, they talked to us a lot about freedom. And it was a lot of little sprinkles, because there was still a lot of lies that we were believing and a lot of stones that I was like holding in my heart that were stopping me from really accepting it. And so there was a process of just sprinkling little truths on us all the time, and until I actually got free.
What happened?
When I got free, I felt like I had a pretty good understanding of what like freedom was and everything that Jesus offers us and did for us. And I was like, okay, yeah, it makes so much sense. But I was like, I don't know about mine though. Like, mine's pretty bad. I don't think I can be free from this. And my big one was fear, like fear and anxiety and self-worth. And that I was still living in it, because I had yet had another situation that had validated that something really bad could happen to me. And that's whenever I was pretty far along. I was probably like 34 weeks when the doctors found out that Wesley had some brain malformities. And they looked at me and in the middle of the ultrasound, and they were like, I don't know what this is, but I'm going to bring the doctor in. The doctor looked and was like, this doesn't look good. It looks like a cyst. It doesn't look like the septum pollutum is formed for a connection to both sides of his brain. And I was like, what does that mean? And he said, we don't know. We won't know until he's born. And I just stopped. And I felt God's presence over me. And I did not have anxiety in that moment.
Wow.
I heard, be still. I don't know how I heard it, but like I felt it. And the doctor was like, do you have any questions? And I was like, no. And he left the room. And he came back like 10 minutes later. And he asked how old I was. And I told him, and he was like, you are very strong. And I was like, that's not me. I was like, I know God's got my child. And I just, for some reason, I just knew that he was going to be okay. And there was no more questions after that.
Mercy. So this is all happening right before.
I kind of like, I messed up the sequence, because I had gotten free. That was like a big thing. I had gotten free a week prior to that.
Tell me about that.
So I was still very anxious, and Tyler was like, you know what? Like, you know all these truths. Like, it's time to like, let's talk to God and let's like call out these lies over your life. And so we sat at the beach and we just started praying together. And I asked God to reveal to me the lies that were holding me captive, that were keeping me in this mindset that I am anxious and I am angry and I have no future. And he just started revealing things to me, and he revealed fear. And I realized that I was holding on to fear, and fear of condemnation, fear of if I acknowledged God and I acknowledged Like, I was believing a lie about him, that he was going to condemn me and my sin, and that I was just this evil person. And I gave that up, and I realized, like, there is no condemnation for me because I am in Christ Jesus. And so I didn't have to keep repenting all the time saying, please forgive me. Please don't send me to hell. Please don't hate me. And because I am righteous, like I am clean, and I'm not this just evil, disgusting, angry person that I thought I was. When he revealed to me all those things, I could come to him not from a place of fear and I'm so dirty, please help me, please forgive me, but I could just come to him for rest and without fear of condemnation. And I could trust him with my future. I was no longer like, I don't have a future and I'm just gonna sink into that and just fall apart. I was like, I don't know what my future is, but God does. I just felt like I was lifted up and I was just held by him, and I knew that everything was going to work out. And so I wasn't afraid of anything going forward. I was no longer looking at other people to validate me, because I know what he thought of me. I wasn't that disgusting, sinful little girl. I was his child. I am his child. And so I didn't have to look for validation from the world, because he loves me and because that's what he says about me. And so it was just this, I remember I just took a breath and I was like, I feel so light after all of that. I just felt so light. And I just felt,
did you say it out loud?
I said it out loud, and Tyler laughed at me. And I was like, why are you laughing? And he was like, that's what they all say.
It's literally what everybody says.
It's so true. And that was just like, after so many years of just believing, like, I would never climb out of it. Like, I would never climb out of this, like, pile of crap that I've created for myself. For all that to just be broken away because the foundation of it was shifted. The foundation was changed. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm free.
So you start walking in this freedom thing, and little Big Wes shows up on the scene.
Yeah. Wesley shows up on the scene, and he's just so perfect. And he's just perfect. I will say, it was scary knowing that things were going to be a little different. I don't know, man. I think I really messed up the sequencing. I got really excited and I feel like I messed up.
No, you're fine. What did you want to say from before? Add what you wanted to say.
I was just really trying to think of like the sequencing of when I really got free, because it was a walk of like, I understood things, but whenever I really started, like when it really made sense to me, I really started living in freedom. When I came to agreement with that, and I like, it was that beginning phase when Wesley was born was a very just jumbled mess, because it was very scary. The doctors were telling me lots of things. I had postpartum anxiety, and it felt like I didn't exist for a couple months. It didn't feel like I was like alive. It was just a big mess of anxiety and hormones. And I just didn't feel like myself for those first couple months. I was trying to keep my son alive. The doctors were telling me all sorts of scary stuff about him. And it took away that like peace that I got to just hold him and know that he was okay. And that's why I think I actually may have gotten free right after that. Like, I don't remember if it was before or after, actually. I remember that no matter what, it was very scary for me in those first couple months. And I couldn't be the mother that I wanted to be because I was listening to the doctors telling me that if I didn't do this the right way, he could die. And if I didn't do this the right way, he could die. And I needed to do this and this. But I was still mentally felt like I was going crazy.
So what happened after feeling? How long did that last? And what brought you out of that?
What brought me out of it, it lasted, I'd say, 2 months. Because the first 3 days after he was born, something really scary happened. I was like, everything's fine. He's going to be okay. And then something really scary happened. And we ended up back in the emergency room in the intensive care unit. And he got so dehydrated, he almost died. And so he was hooked up to all...
That happened to me.
That happened to you?
It happened to me and my twin sister. Like, we were older. We were probably maybe one, but something got in us and we could not keep anything down, and it was coming out of both ends. And we had to go to the hospital to get an IV and they thought we were in deep trouble.
Yeah.
So when I heard you telling that story for the first time, I was like, oh yeah, that can happen for sure.
Yeah. And it was, oh my gosh, see, like, he's with this bit and seeing them like take your little baby and they just had him hooked up to so many IVs. And when they're under like, when they're under 20 something days, they have an intake checklist that they have to go through because they don't know what's really wrong. So they had to do a spinal tap on him. They had to give him a catheter to take his urine and everything. And it was just like seeing that already just really messed me up, because before we left the hospital, I was telling them, I was like, something's not right. I didn't feel good about leaving the hospital. I was like, can you check him again? I don't feel like something's right. And they're like, he's fine. That next night, he started getting dehydrated and we were rushed back. And then that, it just was again, that thing of, oh my gosh, something bad can happen if I'm not on it. I was like, if I'm not on it, something bad can happen. And I started feeling like a really bad mom. I was like, I can't care for my baby if I'm not looking at him, overanalyzing everything at every moment. Doom is going to come upon us. So I just, that's whenever I was the most anxious. And I was just staring at him like, are you okay? Are you okay? Are you okay? And I was convinced that if I didn't catch something, something bad was going to happen. That was really scary. And it just kept happening. There was no break, because one thing after another, the doctors were saying like, oh, now this is wrong. Now this is wrong. And I think actually that is the point where Tyler and Morgan stepped in. Because also, I mean, your postpartum, that's probably the most closed off from people you'll ever be. And so I was shutting myself in, and it was just me and this baby that I was like staring at, making sure like, I have to keep him alive. I have to keep him alive. I have to keep him alive. And whether or not that was whenever like I got free, there was a crisis going on and I was isolated, and whatever it was, I was believing lies and I wasn't trusting God with my child's life, with my life. I was operating out of anxiety and fear. And that's when Tyler and Morgan stepped in and they saw that. And they were like, we need to sit down. We need to call out some more lies and we need to figure this out. And so they sit down with me and we prayed and we let God assess the situation. And I realized again that I was like, he offers peace and he's going to take care of me. This is not just my baby. This is his baby too. And he cares for my child even more than I care for him. And so I was like, why would he not? It's robbing me. And it's like for me to put it all on myself. Like, he's going to carry this with me. It's not all up to me to be the perfect mom and to be his doctor. I'm not his God. God's got my son. And so I was like, you know what? I trust God to take care of my baby. I trust God that he goes before me and he knows what's right and he knows what he needs and he knows what I need. And so just remembering that God has me and recentering myself and letting him guide my mind and that I had the spirit in me And then if I would just stop and let the spirit guide me, that everything would be okay, that I would know what to do, that the spirit doesn't give me anxiety. God's not giving me that spirit of anxiety. And if I'm staring at my son making a decision because of anxiety, that's not coming from him. And so when I realized, I was like, man, that hasn't been God's spirit that has been guiding me. I've been listening to other lies. I've been letting the lies from the enemy with anxiety and fear guide me. And that's why I felt so just scared all the time. And I just had to align myself again with remembering the truth and operating that way. And that's when there was a turning point around 2 to 3 months of how old Wesley, like 2 to 3 months, whenever stuff started getting better.
Tell me about this thing that happens when he gets a little bit older, and that you were telling the story and it was just blowing my mind about how a doctor, you know what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about. And that's why I was trying to figure out the timeline, because I'm like, I just remember, because there was that time that I came into agreement with the truth and I was like, okay, like from this day forth, like I'm going to believe like that I have the spirit and I'm not going to operate on anxiety. And I had to just make that differentiation. I had to like see the lies and see the truth and then choose to walk in the truth. And it didn't get better in the means that Wesley got better. Wesley didn't get better. Wesley got worse. But I didn't have that. I didn't have the anxiety anymore. I was looking at him as I finally get to be a mother. I get to enjoy the gift of getting to be with him every day. And so when I did start getting uneasy about something, I knew it was actually wrong. I knew it wasn't because I was anxious about every little thing and I was nitpicking. I just knew. And I knew that
what was actually happening.
So his vision seemed a little off. He wasn't making eye contact with me. I took him to the doctor and I was like, I don't think he can see. And they looked at him in the car seat and they were like, he can see fine. And he said his bedside manner was great. He went like this. He just looked at Wesley in his car seat and he said, he's literally looking at me right now. That's what he said to me. I was like, okay. And so I was like, okay, you know what? I'm not going to fight with this doctor to listen to me. So I took Wesley and I left and I said, we're going to go see a different doctor. And I took him to see a civilian out in town. And I was like, look at him. I don't think he can see. And the doctor looked at Wesley and was like, you need to go see a neurologist like right now. And I was like, oh, okay. And so he said, I think he's completely blind. And I think he has nystagmus from some neurological issue going on. And that triggered a whole chain of events of seeing a bunch of different doctors, getting all sorts of opinions. And most of them were that he is blind. And the last doctor we saw was the neurosurgeon that said he's blind. And I think he needs brain surgery.
Do you remember the name of the surgery?
So they wanted to do an open craniotomy and they wanted to remove the cyst because he has a cyst in the middle of his brain and it's sitting like...
Is that what the doctor saw in the when they were doing...
Yeah, it's always been there and it still is there. It's just a cyst midline. It's an arachnoid cyst. And the doctor was saying, I don't know what's causing his blindness. And I also... It doesn't look like the cyst would like cause blindness, but because he's blind and he has a cyst in his brain, that's most likely what's causing it. So I think he said, I think if we decompress this cyst or remove this cyst, that will take pressure off of his brain and could restore his vision. And I just did not feel comfortable with that. That did not set right with me. And I was like, with all due respect, I would like a second opinion. And this doctor kept pushing me and he was like, Jordan, your baby could die. This cyst is on his brainstem. And if it grows, then like his heart could stop if it grows. And I was just like, I don't feel comfortable with this. I was not anxious for his life, but I knew that it just didn't feel right. And that had been God. Like his spirit guiding me and saying, hey, you need to do something else. You need to talk to someone else, because that was not, I don't feel like that was the proper diagnosis. We left and we went and saw a different doctor in Texas. And it was a really hard path to get there because the insurance said that they wouldn't approve any other doctor. They sent us to a neurosurgeon. We didn't like it. They wouldn't approve to send us to another place. But we talked to patient advocacy. We got a case manager. And we just kept going until the insurance agreed to pay $14,000. And they flew us to Texas. And I said, this is...
Wait, what was the $14,000?
The flights, the per diem for food, for hotels. This doctor was not even in network. This was not even...
How did you find him?
I went on Google and I looked up arachnoid cyst and I started doing research on what this cyst was. And I found this great doctor at Memorial Hermann Hospital, which seemed to be, it was like a renowned hospital that people spoke really highly on. And his name was David Sandberg, and he was coming up with all sorts of different surgeries and treatments for these cysts. And he just had a really good knowledge on Wesley's exact condition. And so I went to Wesley's PCM, the one who said, he's not blind, whatever. And I was like, this is what the doctor said, blah, blah, blah. I want to see this doctor. And she was like, that doctor's not in network. You can't see that doctor. And I said, put it in. Send it into the insurance, write the referral just like this. This is his address. And she was like, okay, they're not going to accept it though, because he's not in network. And I was like, I don't care. Send it in. And it got approved. And within 2 weeks, we were on a plane, not 1 cent out of pocket. We were on a plane to see this neurosurgeon in Texas.
So what does this guy say? What did Andy Sandberg, what's his name? Not Andy Sandberg.
David Sandberg.
David Sandberg. What did David Sandberg? Praise God it wasn't Andy Sandberg.
David Sandberg said he did his own set of MRIs and he looked at it and he was like, looking at the three MRIs Wesley's had, this cyst has never grown. It's remained stable in size. I don't see any indication that there's any fluid going into the cyst that could cause it to grow. I also don't see that this cyst is in a place that could cause any sort of correlation to vision impairments. He would not do the surgery. And then he said, what's the name of this doctor that said that? And he looked up his credentials. My new doctor looked up the old doctor's credentials and was like, he suggested this surgery. He read the doctor's notes and was like, okay. And he was like, you need to file a grievance form and pursue like legal matters like that, because he said, if you would have done this surgery, Wesley would be dead, because that surgeon that suggested that was not a pediatric neurosurgeon. He was just a regular neurosurgeon. And my doctor said, Dr. Sandberg said, in an adult, that part of the brain would have been fine to go through. But in a child, that's one of the most highly vascularized areas of the brain. So there would have been like severe brain bleeding, and that would not have been a good option to do an open craniotomy and remove that part of his brain to get to this cyst that was causing no problems, is pretty much what this doctor said.
And so what was his solution?
He said, just go forth and we'll check up on it every couple months. He said that the cysts, there's not a smart way to remove it at this point, and unless it starts to grow, the risk outweighs the reward of removing it.
So then what was going on with the vision there?
So then we just were like, you know what? I'm just happy my baby's healthy and he's alive. And we just kept going on with life. A couple months later, we went to Missouri to visit family. And while we were there, I was like, okay, you know what? I'm going to take him to see an ophthalmologist here. Just check his eyes out. And the ophthalmologist there a couple weeks later checked his eyes out. And she was like, it's right here. She was like, he's got small optic nerves. And I was like, how did they not see that before? And she was like, he was really young. It could have been too early to see that. But she was like, that's why he can't see. His optic nerves are not formed all the way. It has nothing to do with his brain.
Is that something that can grow over time?
No, that's something that happens like whenever like in utero, his optic nerves didn't develop all the way. There's just not a lot of communication back and forth between his eyes and his brain, which is just something that it just a part of his vision now. That's how he sees. And he's learned to manage it. Like, he's doing great now. First, they went from saying like he's completely blind to he needs his brain surgery to then they said like he can possibly see some light. Now he can see 17 feet away. And they didn't say that was a possibility. And this is out without any surgeries or treatment or anything like that.
And so through this whole time, the enemy's trying to put anxiety on you. He's trying to put fear in you.
Yeah.
But you've been walking in truth.
Yeah, I was walking in truth. And I just looked back and I was like, man, if I was still operating from anxiety, I would have got this surgery. Like the doctor would have told me, your baby's probably going to die if you don't do this surgery. And I would have been so anxious and scared, like for my baby's life. Rightfully, you're scared for your baby's life. But I would have listened to the anxiety and fear. And I would have said, whatever you do, just do it. But I knew that the spirit was like guiding me to seek further investigation on that. I wasn't going to accept that because I didn't feel like that was the truth. And we just kept pushing and kept walking in freedom and truth, and everything worked out.
Someone was asking me the other day, how do they know? They were saying how that understanding truth is harder now. And I was like, how? Because before, when I had a thought, I would just think, oh, that's my thought. And then I would think nothing of it. Even if it was negative, it would just, it is what it is. But now when I get a thought, whatever jumps into my mind, I'm starting to think, who is it? Is this from God? Is this from the enemy? What should I do with it? And I'm having like this argument and I'm wrestling all the time with what I should do. And if anyone's listening and is having that experience, and now that you're understanding, not every thought comes from you, and that the enemy does work. The battlefield is your mind that he's playing on. He's fighting for your death.
Yeah.
Then how do you understand and discern what is truth? And this is what I would want to offer. That if it sounds accusatory, that if it feels like it's coming from fear, if it positions you in lack or rushes you to make a hasty decision, then it can't be from your Father in heaven.
That's right.
And that your Father in heaven will speak to you gently and with love. And the gentleness might come in the form of, hey, my boy, that's not the way you should be acting. Or, hey, you like, that's not you anymore.
Yeah.
Where the enemy could be like, oh, you're still the same. You're no longer, you're not a new creation. You're trash. But the enemy will always sound like accusing you, condemning you. And your Father in heaven will never sound like that. And just to hear this story of how you never knew all those thoughts that you were having when you were a kid, that you weren't able to be loved and you had to please everybody because that's the only thing you can add in this world is how you can please people. Like, you didn't know. And then you figured that out through people that love God just pouring into you. And like, it's just, this is a crazy miracle.
Yeah, it's, and that's why I think I had only heard up until that point, being in a scary situation, like an actually scary situation, but not feeling anxiety, but still being like, this, I'm not settled in this. So it was gentle. It wasn't an immediate feeling of that like chest tightening, like my baby could die if I don't do this right now. It wasn't a feeling of like fear. And that's how I knew that it was God's voice and that it was like, it was just a feeling. I still felt light. Like I still felt okay. I still felt taken care of. And it was just, he was just pushing me to go a different route. It wasn't like, do it right now or he's going to die. It wasn't anxiety. And that's up until that point, Like my whole childhood, I had only felt anxiety. I had only made choices and operated based on anxiety. And that's all I had known. That had been my comfort. So the fact that I felt, it felt so free, even in the scariest moment of my life, I felt so cared for and safe. I had never had safety like that before, before I started walking in truth. And I realized that God loves me and cares for me. And he guides me. And that was true safety. And I had never felt that before. So that the reason, like the way I still felt like that, I knew that was God leading me.
So take me back. And I'm trying to think of this either right before you find out you're pregnant and move to Hawaii, or maybe in the first year or so in Hawaii where you and Anthony are not getting along, mm-hmm. and you're feeling anxious and you're feeling scared and you're feeling worthless. Mm-hmm. If you were able to run into that girl right now and you were to able, you see her, the argument's over and one of you's left the house. And if you were able to grab that girl and pull her aside and put your arm around her, what would you tell her now?
I would tell her first, getting out of that argument, stop 100% relying on your spouse to define how good you are, to define if you're safe, to please him, and stop idolizing what other people think of you and what he thinks of you, because your father in heaven, you are his child. And you are good enough. If the creator of the universe has brought you near to him and is telling you, like, I love you, you are my child, listen to that voice, because that's the most important one. And you can have rest and you don't have to idolize other people. Anything that anyone says that's contrary to what your father, like, I had never had a father either before that. So that was I didn't understand the concept of a father, but that God truly loves you and looks at you like you are righteous, you are pure, and you are my child, and you can just like rest in that. Then you are perfect. He made you perfect and he loves you, and you don't have to pick and prod at other people and try to get them to love you to validate yourself. Like, he has validated you because you live in that truth. That's your identity. You are a child of God and he loves you. And if I would have known that I was wholly loved no matter what, then I wouldn't have been going to other people and acting out in a way to try to get the whole world to love me. Because I don't need love from the whole world.
When we first started talking about Wesley, you said, I think you said it three times, you said he's perfect.
Yeah.
He's perfect. And we understand that he has small optic nerves, right? Mm-hmm. So in the sense of like his body, your body, my body, we're not perfect in the way the world uses the word perfect. But in our Father's eyes, he sees us just the way Wesley.
I think the same way that I'm like, what makes him perfect to me? I'm like, I love him so much. I love him so much. He's perfect to me. So it's our Father loves us so much. We're literally perfect. We're literally perfect to him. It's just that transforming love. Man, love is powerful.
I love it. Jordan, thank you so much for sharing your story. You're a blessing and a testimony to us. I remember hearing about you, and Tyler and Morgan were just like, yo, we're so excited that these people are seeing this truth.
Yeah.
And so you've been a blessing and a testimony to us that God is love. And so thank you so much for sharing your story. You're a blessing.
Love you guys too. I know you hold me down. Hold me down. Clear sky is pouring down. I've seen your faithful hand. No need to worry about my life. Peace of mind and knowing I'm found. I'm found. It's only you, it's only me. Waking up to a memory. Your love is all I need. It's only you, it's only me. Waking up to a memory. Your love is all I need.
Time I lay it down, you take it. I feel it.